And good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HTI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force. I'm Mike Ferry with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. We have a number of ONC subject matter experts joining us today, and we have an external subject matter expert, Mohammed Tafari, is joining us, and thank you, everyone, for participating today. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is welcomed, which can be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting or can be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at the end of our meeting this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members. So when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning. Welcome, everyone.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Hans Butendeck and Hannah Galvin and Elio Oliveira are all unable to join us today, but hopefully they'll be back next time. Sanjeev Tandon is joining us today from CDC in place of Adi. I don't see him on yet, but he should be joining us shortly. Devin McGraw.
Good morning, everybody.
Bill Sutherland.
Good morning, everyone.
And Cheryl Turney.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, everyone, as well. Now, please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane and Steve Eichner for their opening remarks.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. We have come a long way together in this work group number one for our HTI-1 task force. Very excited to be covering the new material that we'll be touching on today. Let's review the agenda here briefly. We're going to review our charge, talk about specifically the new condition, manner exception exhausted, and then speak about a request for information included in the NPRM regarding health IT capabilities for data segmentation and user patient access, an area that is near and dear to my heart, and I know many of you as well. We'll then have public comment 10 minutes before the noon hour Eastern time. And we really do want to encourage members of the public to take advantage of the public comment period. In addition, you are welcome to utilize the webinar chat as we proceed through the meeting and enter ideas there. We may or may not have time to take them up during the course of the meeting. So with that, Ike, do you want to add to our welcome at all?
Just again, reemphasizing Stephen's welcome to task force members and members of the public. I will be keeping my eyes on chat so that Stephen can focus on some other things and we'll bring things to his attention as we need to.
Excellent. Well, let's go ahead then in the slides and just review the charge and remind ourselves where we are today. So this was the overall charge of the HTI-1 task force. I'm not going to reiterate it, but point out that today we are focusing on enhancing information sharing with regard to the information blocking regulations and looking at some advances and refinements related to that. Next slide. These are the other charges for the task force writ large. I also will remind everyone who's attending that these materials are available and posted on the public internet. And I don't know, Ike or Mike, if you have a chance, just grab that link to today's meeting and drop it in the chat for the benefit of our attendees. Next slide. So our group one, was asked to focus on a number of items. These are they, and we are now down at the last two of this list, having been through all of the preceding non-highlighted bullet items here. Today, we are focusing on the manner exception exhausted again and the request for information around data segmentation. And the next slide. So we are now going to have Cassie and Dan and Rachel walk us through these two items. We are then going, we have an invited subject matter expert who is also going to provide some input, especially on the data segmentation question. And then we will go on and discuss all of this. But again, feel free to put items into the chat. Ike will be monitoring that, and we may break into the presentation with questions if that seems appropriate, or we may hold them to the discussion at the end. So with that, Cassie, Dan, Rachel, do you want to walk us through the proposed changes in the rule?
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephen, and thank you, everybody, for joining us this morning. Next slide, please. I know we have a full agenda today, so I'll jump right into things. Before we get started with the content of the presentation, I'm going to give a little bit of a background and a couple of disclaimers that some of you may have heard before if you've joined us previously. And then I'll turn to my colleague Cassie to talk about one of the discussion items, our first discussion item today, and then come back when we talk about the segmentation request for information. But first, a brief disclaimer. The materials contained in this document are based on the proposals in the Health Data Technology and Interoperability Certification Program Updates, Algorithm Transparency and Information Sharing Proposed Rule. While every effort has been made to ensure the accuracy of the restatement of those proposals, this document is not a legal document and the official proposals are contained in the proposed rule. I'd also note that other federal, state, and local laws may also apply. I'd also note that ONC must protect the rulemaking process and comply with the Administrative Procedure Act, and that during the rulemaking process, ONC can only present the information that's in the proposed rule as it's contained in the rule, and ONC cannot interpret that information or clarify or provide further guidance. And lastly, this communication is produced and disseminated at US taxpayer expense. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, I'll start off with a brief overview and some background of the topics that we'll be discussing today, and then we'll jump into the content. So as Stephen mentioned, we have two topics on the agenda. The first is a new proposal relating to the information blocking and feasibility exception. It's a new condition as part of that exception, the manner exception exhausted proposal. And then the second topic for today's discussion is a request for information on health IT capabilities for data segmentation and user or patient access. Next slide, please. And again, we'll start out with some background. Next slide. Great. And so here I'll turn it to my colleague, Cassie Weaver, to start the discussion on the first part of what we'll cover today, the manner exception exhausted proposal.
Thanks, Dan. Good morning, everyone. I'm sure you're tired of seeing my face at this point, but we really are nearing the finish line here and looking forward to the feedback we're going to get from you all. So I pretty remember last week we talked about some other proposed updates to the infeasibility exception. And today I'll finish that topic for us with one final new proposed condition. Thank you. That's very nice of you. The manner exception exhausted condition. So this proposed condition would apply where an actor is unable to fulfill a request for access, exchange, or use of EHI despite or after having exhausted the content and manner exception in 171.301. Which we have proposed in this proposed rule to rename the manner exception, including offering all alternative manners in accordance with 171.301B, so long as the actor does not currently provide to a substantial number of individuals or entities similarly situated to the requester the same requested access, exchange, or use of the EHI. So next slide, please. I'm going to just really quickly kind of review the content manner exception. So what does it mean to exhaust it? So first of all, it means the actor and requester either couldn't reach agreeable terms on fulfilling the request in any manner requested, or that it was technically infeasible for the actor to provide the access, exchange, or use in any manner requested. As a reminder, when the actor does provide the requested access, exchange, and use in any manner requested, then they are not restricted by the fees and licensing exceptions and can come to any agreement with the requester, although other laws may restrict charging of certain fees and things like that. If the actor they are unable to reach agreement or can't technically do it, then the actor moves to the alternative manners, in which case those restrictions in the fees and licensing exceptions do apply, and the actor must fulfill the request in an alternative manner agreed upon with the requester. And those alternative manners prioritize the interoperable manners based on HHS adopted and available open source standards, beginning with certified health IT, and then other open source standards published by the federal government or a standard setting organization like NIST. And finally, in a machine readable format, along with the means to access. So why are we proposing to add this condition to the exception? For one thing, actors have expressed concerns that a requester could simply refuse to accept any of the alternative manners, because you'll note that the language in that exception does say that the requester has to agree to the alternative manner. And so then if the requester has refused to accept any alternative manners and fulfilling the request would require substantial technical or financial resources, or could result in an outcome that doesn't further interoperability. And so for actors with significant financial or technical resources, that uncertainty could result in their investing in non-standard, non-scalable solutions that they don't support even after they've offered to provide it in the same manner that they generally make available to their customers or affiliates, or through alternative open source standards. So this proposed new condition would help to reasonably allocate resources and relieve some of that uncertainty and confusion. Also, because we don't have authority to give advisory opinions, if an actor does work through those alternative manners and it's unable to reach an agreement with the requester, we can't advise any actor based on those facts whether it would be acceptable to use, for example, infeasible under the circumstances or another exception. And so this proposed condition would also help to fill that gap. Next slide, please. Okay, so just a review of the proposed new layout of the infeasibility exception. First is the uncontrollable events condition, which we updated just to clarify, but didn't make substantive changes to. And we talked about that last week. And then there's the segmentation, which we didn't propose to change. And then we proposed to renumber the conditions so that infeasible under the circumstances will still be the last condition in the infeasibility exception, except now it will be number 5. And then we're proposing to add number 3, third party seeking modification use, which we discussed last week, and number 4, manner exception exhausted, which is what we're talking about today. So just to kind of reorient ourselves, that's where we are. Next slide, please. So in order to satisfy this new proposed condition, an actor would be considered unable to fulfill a request for access, exchange, or use when 3 factors are true. First, the actor could not reach agreement with the requester in accordance with 171.301A, the manner requested condition, which we've proposed to call it in this rule. Otherwise, it would be 171.30A. It's not A now because it's the, that's the manner. Oh, anyway, the manner requested condition, or it was technically unable to fulfill the request for EHI in the manner requested. The second of the 3-part test is that the actor offered all alternative manners in accordance with 171.301B alternative manner, which again, it's as we proposed it in this proposed rule. The citation might change, but it is not substantively different for the electronic health information requested, but couldn't reach agreement with the requester. And third, the actor does not provide the same access, exchange, or use of the requested EHI to a substantial number of individuals or entities that are similarly situated to the requester. And actually, let me step back real quick to the second one. We did put in an alternative proposal for number 2 here, which is rather than say the actor offered all alternative manners, we proposed to say as few as 2 alternative manners, which would mean that an actor could offer it in 2 of those 3 alternative manners and would not have to offer it in all 3. So we are looking for comment on that, which one would make more sense. And then So this third one, I already really went through the first two, just talking about the content manner exception. The third proposed factor is really allowing for a reasonable limit on the use of the condition without having to take into consideration the financial and technical resources available to the actor. This factor as a whole serves a similar function to the 171.204A5, which is currently A3 and feasible under the circumstances. There's those six-factor test there. And in general, this third factor kind of covers a lot of those same sorts of things that the actor needs to consider. Here, the practice is non-discriminatory. Whether the actor currently provides the same manner. Whether currently provides the same access, exchange, or use of EHI to its companies or customers, suppliers, partners, other persons with whom it has a business relationship. This provides sort of a basic assurance that the actors would not be able to misuse this new proposed manner exception exhausted condition to avoid supplying some particular requesters with manners of access, exchange, or use of the requested EHI that would be more generally characterized as generally available already than as new, unique, or unusual. We structured the factor this way to sort of align with the concept of whether the manner requested, including any involved interoperability elements, is in a stage of development or overall life cycle that would roughly approximate the general availability phase of the software release life cycle, or something analogous for non-software interoperability elements. Same access simply means same manner. Substantial number is there because what may be a trivial number to a large health IT developer of certified health IT might be an important or consequential substantial number for a small HIN or HIE. We did propose in the alternative that we would and seek comment on whether we should instead construct the factor with a simple fixed threshold of more than one or more than another specific number between 1 and 10, as opposed to substantial. We recognize the fixed threshold would offer more simplicity to actors and potential requesters, while still assuring that an actor's practice would not fail to meet this factor on the basis of a single instance of a particular access, exchange, or use manner. Similarly situated would be familiar to our information blocking actors, as we also used it in the fees and licensing exceptions. It would serve here, as it does there, to indicate that different specific individuals or entities within a class of such individuals or entities who are similarly situated to one another should be treated in a consistent and non-discriminatory manner. So let's do next slide, please. The proposed revisions, next slide. So I'm just going to leave this up while I talk to this slide a little bit more and offer some examples from the preamble that I think really will help illustrate this for everyone. So to illustrate the situation, we see and believe this new condition is necessary to remediate. For example, an actor that develops or offers certified health IT may be uncertain as to whether an exception covers its practice of denying a requester's demand for access, exchange, or use in a particular manner that relies on unique specifications instead of interoperable standards. Because the actor has capabilities and resources that it could potentially divert to the requester's preferred manners. In such cases, the actor may also lose the opportunity to pursue other innovative endeavors or fulfill other customer requests. Those opportunity costs would arise, in other words. Healthcare provider and HIN, HIE actors with substantial technical or other resources would also face or also currently face demands from requesters who are interested only in their own preferred mechanisms, however unique and non-scalable. We're concerned that actors currently appear to experience such uncertainty, even if the actor, to continue the illustration, is offering the requester interoperable manners of access, exchange, or use based on open consensus-based industry standards, and diverting resources to build the new manner would mean the actor would need to delay for months or more deployment of innovations that will reduce burden on clinicians using the software. In these cases, we currently cannot advise these actors whether or not the requester's demand is infeasible in the actor's unique circumstances. Again, because we requested and have not received advisory opinion authority from Congress. Therefore, this new condition, proposed condition, we believe is necessary to let actors reasonably allocate resources towards interoperable standards-based manners, rather than allowing requesters who, for whatever reason, do not build their products for compatibility with open consensus standards or other industry standards to attempt to force use of non-standard, non-scalable solutions by simply refusing to accept access in any other manner. So I think if there aren't questions right now, we can move on, but this would be the end of the manner exception exhausted portion of the presentation. Devin, I see you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
I can, yes.
Okay, great. My question is about whether, so I'm trying to figure out, particularly around the alternative where you sort of don't necessarily have to exhaust all three options, but might be able to potentially exhaust two. In the context of health information exchanges or other types of actors that don't adopt certified technology, you're already arguably down to two. So if you get to pick two, does that mean that the third option, which is sort of the catch-all negotiation option, is off the table? You're sort of, and then you're sort of forced into the, you might be sort of held over a barrel by the actor who says, you know, it's this particular way or no way. And I mean, I have a few concerns about that. I very much get that you don't want the requesters to sort of put the actors in the awkward and untenable position of having to sort of do bespoke solutions for everyone that asks or to adopt mechanisms for exchange. But particularly in the case of HIEs who customarily have served a very narrow class of requesters for very narrow purposes, I'm trying to sort of think through what you guys were thinking in terms of dropping down to fewer than all three alternative manners when, you know, you've already got some classes of actors for whom one of those alternative manners is off table.
Mike, I see you're on video, so I'm going to let you in.
I'll jump in. So this is, you know, I think it's a lot to process because in terms of what exists today, right? So, and we did this in the info blocking presentation last week, and I understand not everybody can make every presentation that we give, but we thought it was important to start there. So let's start with the content and manner as it exists today, right? That exception. In putting aside the content, as we all know now, it's all EHI. And the first thing we talked about in that discussion, the preamble, and for that exception, is that we wanted parties to come together and reach agreement on how the EHI was access, exchange, or use, right? So we let them. So the whole first part of it is try to reach agreeable terms, and if you do, it's not, you know, if that's reasonable, necessary, and you're out of information blocking altogether, right? But what we said is, like, if you can't reach agreement, there's this alternative manner process. But the actually the most key piece on the alternative manner process as it exists today that I don't want folks to lose sight on is it has to be agreed to by the requester. So if you look at every one of those provisions, and it has a priority of order, right? And we talked in the rule about how, you know, we're trying to promote interoperability, also the use of certified health IT, and we're trying to make, you know, trying to improve the certified health IT so they can make more EHI accessible. So those providers that use it and developers, you know, we can get closer to interoperability and help support their ability to comply with information blocking. So we have, you know, we start there, and then we got standards. And then last case, you know, argument in the rule was that we want to try to get the EHI out. So if it's in a machine readable format, that's an okay approach too. But remember, each one of those have to be agreed to by the requester. So it doesn't mean that the actor can just say, I'm going to offer you this, I'm going to offer you this, I'm going to offer you this, I'm done. They don't get the benefit of that exception unless it's agreed to by the requester. And then the fees and licensings apply the exceptions in all those cases, right? And so if they still don't reach agreement after all that, then it kicks over into the infeasibility exception. And if you remember under the circumstances as it exists today, one of the six factors, and there's two factors you can't include, which are like competition and whether it changed how much you can charge. One of those factors is why the EHI wasn't provided through the content and manner, right? So it's just one consideration of the whole evaluation of the various factors under that situation. So I want to stop there, just in that little kind of summary of how it works today before we talk a little more about, make sure everybody understood that piece before we talk more about what's being proposed here. Because the biggest thing about being proposed, what's being proposed here, is that there's no longer, I agree from the requester, like to take it that way. It's going to be like this way, or that's it. As long as they meet every one of the proposed exceptions, or proposed conditions, sorry.
Yeah, that's helpful, Michael. Thank you very much. I think that we may consider when we get into discussion phase a potential comment around whether, particularly from, if you think about actors that for which mm-hmm. one of those alternative manners just gets completely off the table because they don't use certified health IT, whether that's whether that puts them off the hook too much. But that's for comment.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the purpose of this, is to tease this out and get the best comments so that we can consider what's the most appropriate final policy based on public comment. So most importantly is everyone understands it. I don't want to color anybody's opinion on it. I do want to talk about what are potential consequences, unintended or otherwise, of you know what's being proposed. Because I think that is most important that everybody here understands. And then you express your views on whether you agree, disagree, or what could be changed. The other, one other piece. So the reason why it's set up as it is today, because like, what if I want it this particular way, right? Like you're offering it to certain people. It's a proprietary way maybe, but you're like, if I, let's say they have ill intent, right? But we don't know that yet, but this is just a hypothetical fact pattern. And they're like, well, I'm not going to give it to you that way because you'll create competition for me. And I'm actually providing that service to my providers. And then you may siphon off some of my my business. So you say no. And then you offer it all these other ways. And you're like, as a requester, I'm not going to agree to those because I can't access it that way. I know I can access it that way because I do it for a different use case already. I just want to expand the use cases I offer to the provider, and you're not letting me do it because you won't give me that access. So I say no to all that. And so, like I said, it kicks you over into the under the circumstances. And that's the key one, because that's what you look at and say, well, why are they? Because remember, one of the factors is, are they providing it to their partners and businesses? So that's one of the current factors now under the circumstances. And also, what's the resources? What's their technical resources? What's the cost to them? So then it looks at it to see, is there any pretext, right? Why are they saying no there? Is it because, is it for one of the forbidden reasons that it would create competition? So that's how that all gets evaluated. On the flip side, you heard from Cassie today, is like, well, that creates a lot of uncertainty, because if they are acting in good faith, the actor, they may be forced to like, man, I don't know if like, I'm not really, it's not a competition thing for me why I'm saying no to them, but I'm not sure how this would play out in an evaluation by OIG. And so do I have to completely change my business model and take away all my resources? Cause I have a lot of resources and I have to take them away from doing other innovative things to meet all these particular one-off interface requests or connections. So that's kind of what we're trying to, we've heard feedback on and what we're trying to, I think, address with this proposal.
That makes sense. Thanks, Michael.
Yep, no problem.
Ike?
Thank you. Mike, you made an excellent point at the last. That was kind of what I was going to get to, not so much for the question, but comment, is that it feels as though we're developing a really complex framework here that is going to be difficult for smaller healthcare providers or smaller technology providers to understand or meet. And we're running some risks of spitting off a whole series of one-off solutions without necessarily getting a collection of those interfaces or purposes behind them, which limits the ability for other actors to reuse or request a duplicate of somebody else's access, and then the potential for the data provider to not recognize the similarity between two different providers' special requests. So really creating a complex framework in that area. And I'm just a little concerned that we're creating a big rabbit warren here.
Yeah, so just a couple points back on that. And also, I'm not sure if I even answered Devin's one point, but I think I did. I think I can confirm she was right. Like, under the alternative, if you're an HIE, you probably don't have certified health IT, so you are already at two ways. I think our biggest concern there, as Cassie mentioned too, is if you limit it to two, where folks that do or could have certified health IT, they may not, you know, it could actually work as a disincentive to one, not adopt certified health IT, and or to donate certified health IT if you limited it, like if I can work around having to even do the certified health IT one when I could possibly adopt it or purchase it, right? So that's more the rationale that was going on there. But to your point, Ike, so a couple things here. One, we are trying to simplify it, even though it may not seem that way. In that it is trying, so the example I gave, it is trying to get to that. If you are offering it to a bunch of people already, and it's not like a one-off, you made it custom for someone, and there, that's why we're asking, like, is it the same manner? Do you offer to a substantial number of people? Because if you are, then you're going to have to offer to them, or you're not getting this exception. You're likely also not meeting the current under the circumstances exception. And the other piece to this all is obviously there's the actors that are covered here are, it's so diverse. And I think that's the other piece. So versus like creating exceptions for somebody who has certified health IT, exceptions for, different technologies was not the way we approached developing the exceptions. We approached them in a way, I think, as you guys all know, to cover all the actors. So that was the other.
Right. And I guess to go on to myself, I guess the other difficulty is looking at what constitutes a potentially different request in terms of saying, oh, I want one additional field.
Right. The same. Right. That gets to, is it the same? Right. And then there's a few things. Right. And then, are they similarly situated? Those are two obviously interpretive words that we've tried to clarify our intent in the rule, but that may not be even sufficient from your perspective. So yeah, that's definitely something we're hoping to hear.
I think it really could, and we can put it in comment. It's really looking at clarity and predictability and really thinking about smaller providers that don't have a whole host of resources to even contemplate whether an exception may or may not apply, let alone how to actually fulfill a data request.
Okay, Mike, your hand is still up. Have you completed your input here?
Yes, done. Sorry.
Great, no problem. All right, well, I invite work group members to enter your suggestions in the spreadsheet. Thank you, Cassie and Daniel, for going through that. I think this is fairly non-controversial and probably helpful, moving us slightly in a better direction, which is, I thank you guys for that. And I'd really like to move on to our second topic.
Great, thanks. I'm going to hand it back to Dan at this point.
Great, thanks, Cassie. And I will speak a little bit about today's second topic, our request for information. Next slide, please. So I'll start out with some background, and I just would also note that, the as the text that we have on the slides today is pulled from the RFI, but it doesn't represent the totality of the RFI or all the examples that we have therein of different situations that we'll talk about. So I would, you know, always encourage everybody to read the RFI in full. But just to start out with some background, you know, we noted that ONC believes that data segmentation is integral for enabling access, exchange, and use of EHI, and that while there are initiatives like security tagging capabilities and other initiatives that are present and represent an initial step towards further enabling appropriate access, exchange, and use of EHI, that's in accordance with applicable law and patients' preferences, that there are additional challenges to data segmentation that remain. And I'll talk about a few of those in the some of the examples that we give in the RFI here. But broadly, we've received public feedback indicating that there's a significant amount of variability in health IT products' capabilities to segment data, including the ability to enable differing levels of access to data based on the user and the purpose. There may be many situations in which segmentation of data may be required or requested, including use cases where special handling or other restrictions on access, exchange, or use of particular EHI or portions of EHI is either required by law or consistent with a patient's expressed preference regarding their own or others' access to their EHI. Next slide, please. And so here we have pulled out from the RFI the four bullets on various areas that we note in which we're seeking comments. And as you can see here in the RFI, when we talk about segmentation, we're speaking relatively broadly. I just wanted to note that because I know there are sometimes various technical, you know, meanings for terms like segmentation or other terms. And just wanted to note that, you know, as we can see here in the RFI, we're seeking comment across a variety of areas. And we have those four areas laid out here. So the first is that seeking comment on steps we might consider taking to improve availability and accessibility of solutions that support healthcare providers and other information blocking actors' efforts to honor patients' express preferences regarding their EHI. We're also seeking comment on the capabilities of health IT products to segment data and support providers and other actors in sharing information consistent, again, with patient preferences and applicable laws that are relating to access, exchange, and use of and disclosure of EHI. We're also seeking comment on experiences with the availability and utility of certified health IT products' capabilities to segment data in some of the various use cases that we'll mention today, as well as others that are included in the proposed rule. And then lastly, we're seeking comment on how greater consistency in provider documentation practices could enhance the feasibility of some of the technical segmentation solutions that exist, as well as on barriers to those technical feasibility solutions that are presented by local, state, and federal regulations that may apply to various situations. So that's an overview of the areas in which we're seeking comment on this particular RFI. And for the next couple of slides, I'll just talk briefly about some of the examples that we give in the RFI relating to some of the things we've heard and some of the specific examples that you know, are illustrative of some of the things we're seeking comment on. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, through public forums and other correspondence with ONC, some interested parties in the healthcare community have conveyed that their certified health IT lacks capabilities to differentiate the timing of release of certain EHI based on patients' individual preferences. Some interested parties have also indicated that their certified health IT may have little or no ability to restrict a patient's personal representative's access to only some of the patient's EHI, looking at that EHI electronically through a portal or API, or to hold back only some pieces of the patient's EHI in response to the patient's request, while at the same time honoring the patient's preference for the rest of their EHI to be shared with another of their healthcare providers. So we note, a couple examples, one of which, patients expressing a preference for delay of the availability of certain information to them, such as through the patient portal, for another example, an actor choosing to honor a patient's request that that actor withholds certain information from particular access exchange or use, consistent with the individual's right to request restrictions under the HIPAA privacy rule, or the information blocking privacy exception as well. Next slide, please. So we seek comment and we seek to support actors' efforts to honor patients' expressed preferences that the law allows, as well as actors' needs to comply with all applicable tribal, state, or federal laws that may restrict or place specific preconditions on the permissibility of information access and sharing in certain situations. And below we have some other examples that we note in the RFI where some of these considerations may come into play. First, we note that there could be a scenario where a healthcare provider needs to prove or validate consent of the patient regarding EHI that's subject to specific types of restrictions related to confidentiality of substance use disorder patient records, or other federal or state or tribal law with specific consent requirements prior to sharing that information with another healthcare provider who's treating the same patient for other clinical concerns. A second example we note is that a healthcare provider needs to identify and segment from particular access exchange or use data that's subject to varying state laws requiring special handling or access restrictions in such situations. And we note some examples of that type of data here, behavioral health information, certain diagnoses or genetic testing information, for example. And then thirdly, example where an actor's practice meets the conditions of the preventing harm exception for withholding EHI from access, exchange, or use, for example, such as access by the patient or by a patient's personal representative, where some but not all of the EHI an actor has for a particular patient would be involved in that situation where the preventing harm exception would apply. So those are some examples we have. Stephen, I see your hands up, so I'll pause there.
Thanks, Dan. I did not mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to sort of get in line to make some general observations once you've presented. So,
great. Ahead. Okay.
My bad. Problem.
No worries. I think we have maybe one more slide on this. So I will go, if we could go to the next slide. Okay, and then so we wanted to just include a few more examples here that we know in the RFI of things that we've heard from, you know, at least some healthcare providers and their patients as well around challenges or technical limitations that they have encountered as they work to provide patients or their representatives with electronic access to the information that they want when they want it. And some of the examples of those challenges include a certified EHR. I think we mentioned this before, you know, currently in use that as implemented is only capable of offering all or nothing release of EHI test results for patients immediately to the patient portal without offering the ordering clinicians or other healthcare professionals the ability to flag or withhold individual test results for an individual patient from the patient portal. Another example may be that a current certified EHR is designed and implemented such that any test result the patient and healthcare provider want to have available to the patient in the portal must be manually pushed to the portal result by result by the ordering clinician. And then a third example, we note that, you know, existing segmentation tools or modalities, for example, some segmentation capabilities that are applied by broad data class rather than the level of an individual data point may not provide enough flexibility to address more complex use cases, such as honoring a patient's request to have immediate access to most of their EHI, but to have electronic access to some EHI, such as some test results that may be complicated to interpret or indicate the potential of a certain diagnosis released only after those results have been explained to the patient in real time by a healthcare professional, if that is the patient's express preference. So I think this was all of the slides that we had on this and wanted to go through some of these examples. And then that being said, you know, broadly, I would just also kind of point back to the previous slide. I think it was maybe 21, where we discussed the various areas in which we are seeking comment more broadly in this RFI. Knowing that those are a lot of examples, there's a lot of specific examples and scenarios as well, but wanted to just provide those as kind of an illustrative sample of what we have in there. So I will pause here. I know we're going to have another guest speaker as well on this topic. So I'll pause here for comments or questions before we turn to the next portion of our discussion today.
Thank you so much, Dan, and apologize for the premature hand raise earlier. I like using the hands as a cue, but that's just me. As a, you know, clinician and someone who really believes in the importance of privacy and has had the pleasure of working in a healthcare organization that really took all of the information blocking implementation very seriously and was working with a vendor that was very collaborative and developed a lot of tools, I can tell you that even in that situation, this stuff is really hard. There's no question that providers, you know, and other actors want to be able to respect patient preferences and to comport with applicable law, you know, both federal and state. And of course, the state laws vary tremendously in what they can require. So I think it's very exciting that this is in the NPRM. I look forward to, you know, seeing some proposed rules about this and upgrades to the health IT certification requirements. I think this is a great opportunity to really clarify, you know, what is going to be needed. I mean, I will just observe that this ability for being able to respect patient or provider specified delays, being able to respect delays and workflows required by state law that may require certain actions to occur before information can be released, you know, either to a portal or by API is going to be really important. One thing that's really frustrated me is that when I go through all the trouble to document and implement an information blocking exception, say for harm or for privacy, that has no impact on how that data is then shared out to other entities that have a valid right to receive it, and that they don't receive with it the metadata that says that this was blocked for harm, for example, or for patient preference and privacy. So then when it's received at the requesting organization, those constraints are not traveling with it. So I think this is great. I think we really need to get a lot of detail in here. I'm sure you're going to be getting a lot of public comment on this. But I do look forward to our work group collecting some useful feedback as well. I do want to pass it on to our invited subject matter expert, Mohammed Jafari. I can think of no one that I know who's given more thought to this than Mohammed, who also really understands the existing technical tools that are available to support data segmentation, both their past, present, and future. So not seeing any other hands or comments, Mohammed tells me that his presentation will take about 10 minutes. So let's pass it on to him, if that's okay with you, Dan.
Yes, I think so. And apologies if I had, I think we may have a couple other slides just.
That's fine. Mention, yeah, go ahead and put them out then.
So if we could go back to the previous slide there. So we just wanted to mention this proposal, and I think I'll turn it over to my colleague Rachel Nelson here just to talk a little bit about this other proposal, because we noted it was of interest to the work group. So I'll turn it over to Rachel to talk about this portion of the presentation here.
In the interest of time, I will talk fast. This is more of a preview of coming attractions on a related topic, as Dan just noted. In another section of the HTI1 proposed rule, section 3C10, if you have the slides, if you received the slides for today, that link should actually take you there. There is a proposed certification criterion, a primary proposal, and several proposals in the alternative, and we're really looking for comment from folks on that proposal and the alternative proposals. So tomorrow, the proposed criterion supporting technical capability for honoring a patient's right to request a restriction on certain uses and disclosures of their PHI will be discussed in Task Force Workgroup 2, which is open to the public, but we just, recognizing it's outside the charge of this particular work group, we wanted to remind everybody that is here, including members of the public, that a deeper dive into that proposed criterion will occur tomorrow at the publicly open Task Force Workgroup 2 meeting. Next slide. There's two slides. Next slide. There's just two slides on how to submit a comment. I think a lot of folks here already know this, but you're welcome to snag a copy of these slides from today's materials or from last week's information blocking public webinar slides, which are available right now. If you know folks who are interested in commenting, maybe they're patients, maybe they're patient advocates, and they want to comment and they're not sure how, feel free to share the slides. And with that, unless there are questions or comments about how to submit a public comment into the rulemaking process, separate from the HITECH process, I'm going to hand it over to guest SME Mohammed Jafari.
And Rachel, I'm sorry, before we pass it to Mohammed, can you just briefly clarify? So tomorrow, and thank you for clarifying this, we are going through an actual proposed new criterion, you know, looking at the options there. Today, and I know that the ONC had originally intended that we would do that before we had this conversation. So can you just try to clarify as much as possible what today's RFI is asking for, separate from the commentary on the new proposal?
What else could you use? In very simple terms, recognizing we made that proposal for new certification criterion specifically focused on supporting patient preferences related to their right to request a restriction on uses and disclosures of their PHI under the HIPAA privacy rule, and it cross-references a very specific HIPAA privacy rule section, 45 CFR 164.522. What the RFI is asking about, and that's part of why there are so many different example use cases that we list in the full RFI, is what else? What other use cases, think about what other use cases you might need to adjust timing. You might, have folks not wanting to see things quickly, but they want to see them. If you look at the proposed criterion would require in terms of functionality that the certified module would have to have, the RFI says, having proposed that, what other use cases to look at? What other, what other functionalities would be useful? And give us some information on what else might help you do the kinds of things that I think have even been talked about today, such as, filter what a patient sees according to the patient's own preferences, as opposed to letting them limit what other people see.
Yeah, so this is what else do we need in addition to what we're going to talk about tomorrow, which is a little awkward, I acknowledge. So let's jump in. And again, Mohammed is going to be with us tomorrow as well. So we will, start the conversation a little bit reverse order today. And I'm sure by the end of the week, it will be clear. Mohammed, let's bring up his slides.
Thank you. And thanks, Stephen, for inviting me to this meeting. I appreciate the opportunity and thank you for your kind words. I'm going to go through some very broad comments quickly and hopefully we'll have some time to discuss them. My apologies if I'm not very familiar with the operating details of the meeting here. I just prepared something that was very broad. I know that some of the details may be more of interest here, so we can hopefully have that conversation later or tomorrow. So the first thing I wanted to discuss and bring up is the coupling between patient preferences and patient consent and data segmentation. I think we, in any way, if we want to prescribe anything or require, I think we need to be mindful of the how these two concepts are very related and they're tightly coupled. Patient preferences basically are where the granular policy rules are recorded, and data segmentation creates those segments and the granular breaking down of the data. And I think the discussion of these two sets of requirements being in tandem. I think someone needs to go on mute. The second point I want to raise is about the importance of interoperability and standard tags. Even though the mechanisms behind segmentation and labeling could be proprietary, the outcome and how the labels are recorded, it's important for that to be interoperable and standard. Otherwise, we will lose interoperability between the policy expression and the policy enforcement. For example, a consent that is captured or recorded by one organization would not be able to be enforced by another organization if that disconnect exists and the labels are not interoperable. The third point I wanted to raise is that because in the reality of the system today, data often flows in different forms. We need to be mindful of that in requirements for segmentation to make sure there's no backdoor or loophole. If data is segmented with when it's released in FHIR, but you know it's not segmented when it's released with V2 with another provider, then that could create a loophole for the enforcement of the policies that we have in mind. The fourth point is about the incremental implementation. This is both about the requirements and the burden of the requirement on implementers, but also about certifying products and how people can make decisions about adopting them. As Stephen mentioned earlier, this stuff can be complicated and hard, and it is important for us to be mindful of the fact that if we provide a stepwise incremental level of maturity that I will suggest in a bit, I think that could help planning. And that could also help having a vision about where things will go as they mature in the future. Lastly, I want to mention the link between sensitivity classes and clinical concepts. I think sensitivity classes are very much dependent on the clinical concept that are the content of the data elements that we are segmenting. I think lack of consistency or a consistent understanding of what constitutes each sensitivity class and what would cause data to fall within a sensitivity class could lead to another loophole. And for example, if one provider considers a certain type of data, mental health data, and another provider does not, then when data translates between these two systems, there could be an opportunity for the data to be that was considered sensitive in one system to be leaked in another system. So there needs to be some level of guidance in that. Next slide, please. So based on that, I wanted to have some very broad recommendations. I think a cohesive view of granular patient preferences and data segmentation as components in one system is something that I think would be very helpful and important in terms of articulating the requirements and the criteria. I think while there is the broad terminology, the standard terminology that exists, for example, at HL7 right now is very broad, and there's codes that are outdated, there's codes that could be replaced with newer codes. It is important to have some standard code set, and that could be a subset of the existing standard codes that can be identified. This is something that could also tie into the stepwise incremental implementation or requirement in the sense that you know, we can choose for one level of maturity a smaller set of tags, and then for a more advanced level of maturity, a more expansive set of tags. I think confidentiality tags, maybe the basic confidentiality tags of restricted and normal are essential. The sensitivity tags, the ones that correspond most pertinently to the existing regulations and also general expectations of privacy by the patients, and also the common obligations or refrains that would address most of the current common use cases. I think it's the third point I want to make is tying back to the fact that the sensitivity classes are very much tied to clinical concepts, and having some sort of a guidance on that in order to guarantee a level of consistency in understanding of these sensitivity classes across different providers is also key in a consistent enforcement of policies. Next slide, please. With respect to the diversity of methods of communicating data, I think the framework that for data segmentation would be cross-paradigm in a way that it would span different protocols and different forms of data sharing, and the guidance for requiring that in one of these methods should be kind of replicated on the others in order to make sure that the data is consistently segmented across different protocols. And finally, I think I spoke already about the maturity model, and its importance both in planning the requirements and planning the rolling out of the implementation, and also a guidance on adoption of technology by vendors who create products with these capabilities. So with that, I'll stop, and hopefully I didn't rush through this too fast. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mohammed. I'm curious, are you planning on covering the same material tomorrow or different?
To be honest with you, I'm not quite clear. I wasn't quite clear like what the difference would be between today and tomorrow, but I'm happy to adapt and take your advice on that.
Okay. Maybe we can come back to that at the end, or you and I can follow up separately. Devin made a really good point in the chat that the consent policy requirements in many situations do not need to follow the data when it goes from one site to another. And I appreciate that legal point. It's very important. You know, as a clinician and a privacy advocate, my feeling is that when the patient or a provider or a state or jurisdiction goes to the trouble to identify particular requirements, you know, within a setting, that it makes sense to document that and send that along with the data, even if those requirements do not, do not need to be followed, at the recipient, because as a recipient, it would seem advantageous to at least be able to, quote, right click on something, or have it highlighted in such a way as to identify the fact that it was restricted or identified for special treatment at the source, even if you do not have a legal requirement to adhere to that. That's my opinion. I'm curious, Devin or others, whether you feel differently about that, or if that's something that we should be encouraging. And Devin, thanks for raising your hand.
Yeah, no, I don't necessarily feel differently unless the tags through some technical functionality are, trigger, have, additional triggers or that restrict further disclosure or things like that in some sort of automated fashion versus just providing metadata, right? I always thought that at least in multiple discussions that we've had on this topic, which frankly go back decades, there was a desire to create some sort of automated technical functionality for data that was subject to restriction either through a patient preference that was agreed upon to be honored or had to be honored, or through some sort of state or federal policy requirement that it was more than just the metadata tag, but more of a kind of created a functionality for that data to then be restricted. And so if you're just talking about tagging data, that's one thing. If you're talking about those tags translating into something else, then it does create some complication where, there's some automated tools that end up creating some restrictions around data sharing that were not necessitated by law or policy. So there's that to think about. This topic is so incredibly meaty, M-E-A-T-Y, and again, one that, dates back to the original Health IT Policy Committee coming out of the High-Tech Act, if not even earlier than that, and lots of discussion and lots of efforts to move something forward without a lot of success. So it is a topic with a lot of complexity. Having said that, I think it's always a good idea to try to figure our way through this hornet's nest. And it feels like we continue to inch ever closer to something that will work, even though it has taken us a long time to get to where we are and may take us even more time to get some deployment. So I'll stop there. I'm starting to disamuse philosophically, and I'm not sure that's terribly helpful. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Devin. Cheryl, you made a good point in the chat. You want to speak up?
Thank you, Stephen, and apologize for my voice still recovering. But I do think we need to be a little cautious here, because when you consider the fact that certified health IT will in the future exist most likely as well in the framework of TAFCA and other things, I do think that there needs to be some education for the patient, you know, and regarding what limitations mean. And then also, I agree with the comment that Devin just made about the tagging is going to be extremely important, and understanding how that tagging might be, or how other entities that receive that data, who might be HIPAA versus non-HIPAA, might be impacted by these rules. So I do think this is something that maybe deserves a little bit more conversation and maybe some recommendations around patient education.
That's a great point. Thank you. Phil, you made an interesting point in the chat about consent duration and the challenge of managing revocations of consent, or conversely, removal of restrictions. You know, and I'm struck by the fact that, you know, as patients move through the healthcare ecosystem, they might place a restriction, you know, or a restriction might be placed on data in one setting, and then the patient and the data move to another setting where they would then want to remove that restriction or revoke consent that they had previously given to access, exchange, and use of data. And in an ideal world, those changes that happen in organization B would be communicated back to organization A and any other organization that had that data, such that those restrictions would follow the data wherever it is, so that there wouldn't be this leaky boat traveling around, you know, with restrictions being applied in one setting and not in another. I know that's a lot to ask, but it would seem in an ideal world that's what we would want. Now I'm using philosophical. Do you want to add to that, Phil?
Well, as you were talking about that, Stephen, another thought occurred to me of, you know, are we going to have situations that start to occur where maybe as a patient, I'm unaware that I've previously restricted information or inadvertently restricted it, so that there's not proper sharing between providers? And do we need some way to provide transparency throughout all of the various actors that are involved in my care at any given time, so that I can know and essentially audit the consents and revocations that I've put out there, so I don't inadvertently restrict sharing?
Couldn't agree more. You know, it reminds me of, you know, early on at my clinical organization when we were implementing, and we had only this blunt instrument of individuals completely opting out of health information exchange or opting into it. And we kept a list of all the patients who'd opted out and the circumstances of the opt out. And then, you know, our goal was to go back to those people every year and say, do you still want to be opted out of this? You know, you could die because you made this choice. I don't know that we ever actually fully implemented that, but that was always what I was advocating for, because, as you say, restrictions have all kinds of consequences, you know, some of which can be, you know, life altering. And I think a lot of people do, you know, forget when and for what reason they're restricted. Ike, your hand is up.
Yes. Well, it's a little out of bounds for the comment, but still very much related to what Phil just mentioned, which is transparency. One of the things that I'm not sure why we don't have is greater transparency, not just on patient consent, but on disclosures of patient information, that if the transaction is occurring electronically, why is that not available, or a record of that transaction not available to the patient through their portal, both to whom it was disclosed and some indicator about the purpose? Because that would do a bunch of different things. It would help remind patients that, oh yes, I did consent. Oh yes, this is a disclosure purpose that I actually agree with, and understanding how my data is actually being used. And I think that's a missing piece.
It's a really good point, Ike. And it speaks to how complicated this is. I love, Devin, your comment that, you know, we are slowly moving forward. This stuff is so complicated, and in order to make progress, we need to decide what to do and then make sure that the vendors do it in a consistent way. And I love the way ONC has proposed this. So here's the new certification criterion that we're proposing. Let's get that right. And then what's next? You know, what are we going to do in the next iterative round of improving this?
I just to follow up, I see the note in chat saying that it's not currently a functional requirement, but we do require folks to be able to track how their information is being exchanged. So I'm not sure why we don't include, especially for transactions that are going beyond the bound of a certified HIT module, why that transaction isn't recorded. It would seem to me to be logical that it would be.
Yeah, that's all related to some high-tech changes in the accounting of disclosure rule that, again, previous iterations of this committee dug into pretty deeply, and there were some conclusions reached there, but it continues to be actually on the agenda for this committee in terms of the statutory priorities that we're supposed to look at, as I recall. So it could be something to
speak to
ONC about a future work stream.
Right. So. It may be referred to the annual plan. That might be a good thing to do from a task force recommendation space. But I do think with all the other advancements we're making in information exchange, being accountable certainly is a component of it.
Right. So again, I really encourage workgroup members to utilize the spreadsheet to capture your ideas. We will also, we've got a better rhythm going now with the ONC team, taking notes, capturing ideas that then we're going back and adding, you know, for those of you who didn't put them in. Mohammed, thank you so much for your presentation. I am hoping that for tomorrow's presentation, you can talk a little bit more about the existing technical standards if they're not already covered in the ONC presentation, because I think that will help all of us to orient our commentary.
Definitely, thanks.
Great. All right, with that, let's cut to public comment. Really, I'm thrilled to see we've got at least one hand up in the public comment space, but Mike, do you want to do the official invitation?
Sure. We're going to open up our meeting for verbal public comment. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. And I see that Mark Savage has raised his hand. Mark, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. Stephen invited me to flush out a little bit the comment I dropped in the chat about the PCAST report in 2010. This is more of a sort of a general historical or philosophical observation. I know we're talking about segmentation now and metadata and use cases that are feeling very immediate, but it did flash back that we were talking about those issues back in 2010 and earlier as well. And there may be some useful thinking back there or not. I haven't really reflected on that, but I'm reminded that this is an issue that has been with us since the beginning. And thinking of some examples now that sort of fall into this category. So the Gravity Project in its SDOH implementation guide looked at race and ethnicity, sexual orientation, and gender identity. And we realized that it was very important to track the source of the value there. So metadata, was the individual the source of the value? Was the clinician the source of the value? Was perhaps a batch file the source of the value? And so we adjusted the FHIR implementation guide in order to be able to capture and exchange that information. And now we're also looking at the same kind of issue around reproductive health data, critical use case at the moment. So yes, we're thinking about it now, but it suddenly dawned on me that we had been thinking about it back in 2010 as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. And again, it really highlights the point that we're at an important point in the history of this discussion, right? Where ONC really is proposing new certification criteria based on the latest technical standards. So much work has been done by many people over time to bring us to this point. We have both an opportunity and a responsibility to make sure that we take this next step as well as we can and also prepare ourselves for the subsequent step. Okay, I don't see any other hands up from the public. Did you get anything on the phone, Mike?
No, we don't have any other public comments. I'll turn it back to you.
Great. I also don't see hands up from our work group. So maybe, Mohammed, I can invite you to, even though it wasn't on the slides, maybe give us a little this group, a little preview, because I'm sure most of us will also join the discussion tomorrow, of the technical standards that are available to support this. I think part of what we heard from ONC is that they've heard from commenters about the variability across certified health IT. I've certainly seen this myself. I've been in many provider meetings where people say, yeah, you can do that because you use vendor E, and I can't do that because I use vendor C. And therefore, it's an uneven playing field. So you can't expect me to hold me to the same information blocking standards that you hold yourself to. And that's a really awkward situation, right? It seems like we need to have a level playing field in terms of the technical capabilities. So can you speak to those technical capabilities a little bit about where we've been and where we are?
Right. So I think maybe so I can refer everyone to the introduction of the FHIR DS4P IG that's been released recently in the past couple of months. But to provide a quick summary, I think the first data signature standard that I came across with when I started working in the industry was the CCDA data segmentation. There was requirements there about tagging data at the document level, and also there is labeling capabilities at the section level. The FHIR data segmentation for privacy IG kind of takes that to the FHIR space. Those capabilities are now included in the FHIR. I think FHIR came with capabilities for data labeling built in, but what the IG did was to organize and kind of update the categories for terminology and value sets for each of the tag types, for example, confidentiality, sensitivity, integrity labels, and so on. So the most recent, the most updated value sets are included in that IG. They're all referenced to the HL7 terminology. So they're all standard codes within the HL7 terminology. And then the same capabilities have also been added to V2 for including labels on the V2 messages. So I think the version like 2.9 is the one that was added. There was a project that is sort of languished at the security working group that wanted to develop a cross-paradigm IG to sort of create a level of harmonization and consistency for all the three in terms of data labeling. I think that project never took off. That's an idea that stayed in the working group. But I think that there's also implementation guidance in the FHIR DS4P IG, and there's also referencing out to many external resources there. I think that if I were to cite a major, most recent standard, I would cite that standard. I think it's a STEEL-1. It's not a normative standard, but that's the major source of both implementation guidance and terminology.
And I'll maybe go out on a limb and just ask you, since you are a subject matter expert here, given your deep knowledge of these standards, which of them do you feel would be appropriate to require for certified health IT at this point in history?
Right, and that's something I tried to address a little bit in my slides as well. I think the HCS, so there's three references in the current NPRM. There is the HCS standard, which is an abstract standard just describing the concepts of data labeling. And it doesn't go far enough to provide any implementation or concrete implementation guidance. And then there is the CCDA DS4P and the FHIR DS4P that's been mentioned. CCDA DS4P is an older standard and FHIR DS4P is a newer one. I think the value sets in the FHIR DS4P are definitely relevant, and I would think they should be included also because of the importance of interoperability for the actual tags. But I would also advise that we would choose a subset of the terminology that's been defined there, because there is a wide set of values and it would create a lot of confusion. Some of that may not be very clear to implement. So I think defining a subset of the what's defined as the terminology specification in the FHIR DS4P standard would be the most pertinent piece and most ready to implement, I would think.
And have you or others defined such a subset that you would specifically advocate?
There is a recommendation that I helped crafting for SHIFT. There is also a new HIE standard, I think. I'm kind of mixing up the acronyms for privacy consent on FHIR. I think there's a subset that is also identified in that IG, but that IG is now just open for comment. It was just released as a draft, basically. It hasn't reached any status yet. But there's other folks who are also trying to define a subset that would be most relevant to the use cases without, you know, wading into the wider set of values that are in the terminology.
So given that, probably the best we could do would be to recommend that ONC work with relevant stakeholders to define that subset.
Right, which was one of the alternatives basically mentioned in the NPRM, that you know, to require a kind of a modified or a subset of existing standards.
Perfect. Well, that brings us to time. With no hands up, I feel like we've done hard work. I thank you, public. Thank you, Muhammad. Thank you, work group members, for joining us today. This work group has now completed all of our bullets and will work on recommendations at our next meeting. So I again encourage all of you to have your way with the spreadsheet between now and then. And I hope to see many, if not all of you, tomorrow at our work group 2 meeting, where Ike will help to lead us through a discussion of the specific recommendations in the NPRM. So have a great day.